content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the June 12th, 2020 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing shows a very large rendition of George Floyd's face looking at us directly. Below that, it shows a street scene. The buildings are in flames. There are a couple of protesters out. One's holding an American flag upside down and walking across, and another one has got a fist raised and a black power kind of symbol. The title on the cover is "I Can't Breathe." Grief and rage boil over after another police killing of an African American. And that's our first main story. A broken nation mourns, protests, and burns. What happened? President Trump threatened to send the military into American cities this week to quell the violence and looting that have roiled the nation following the death of a black man, George Floyd, at the hands of police in Minneapolis. Hundreds of thousands of protesters turned out in more than 140 cities, galvanized by video footage that showed a white police officer, Derek Chauvin, kneeling on Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes, with three other officers standing by as Floyd, arrested for passing a counterfeit $20 bill, repeatedly pleaded, "I can't breathe." There were hundreds of peaceful protests during the day, but at night many cities were engulfed in violence with windows smashed, stores looted, and stores and police vehicles set on fire. Police fired on crowds, including peaceful protesters, with tear gas and rubber bullets, and clubbed them with shields. "Maybe the next time a white police officer decides to pull the trigger," said Lex Scott of Black Lives Matter Utah, "he will picture cities burning." By Tuesday, curfews were in place in more than 200 cities. National Guard troops had been called up at 23 states. Thousands of arrests had been made, and at least five protesters had been killed. Chauvin, who had 18 conduct complaints on his record, was arrested and charged with second-degree murder. Three officers who were on the scene were charged with aiding and abetting murder. President Trump sounded a defiant tone, calling rioters thugs and tweeting that when the looting starts, the shooting starts. He berated governors during a conference call, calling them weak and telling them they had to dominate protesters. The president threatened to invoke the Insurrection Act and send military troops into cities that failed to defend the life and property of their residents. After police wielding batons and firing chemical spray cleared peaceful protesters outside the White House, Trump strode across the street trailing a phalanx of aides to St. John's Episcopal Church, where he held a Bible aloft. Trump's rhetoric and actions brought widespread condemnation from retired military commanders, church leaders, and even some Republican governors and lawmakers. "Everything he has said and done is to inflame violence," said the Reverend Marianne Budd, Episcopal Bishop of Washington. "We need moral leadership, and he's done everything to divide us." What the editorial said: "In a gruesome parade that never ends," said the New York Times, "before George Floyd were Breonna Taylor, Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Philando Castile, black Americans brutalized or killed by law enforcement officers who rarely if ever, face consequences. Americans have taken to the streets to express a rage born of despair. Trump is pouring gasoline on the flames, said the Boston Globe. Incapable of moral leadership, he is too small for this moment, when strength means not brute force, but rather the compassion and the courage to address the root causes of the nation's discontent. Don't call in the troops, said the Wall Street Journal. Trump is correct that too many local leaders have lost control of their streets, letting peaceful protests be hijacked by destructive radicals and criminals. But the calls to send in the 82nd Airborne are misguided. In the current moment, the sight of troops on U.S. streets would be more likely to inflame the calm than calm. What the columnist said, what you're seeing is people pushed to the edge, said Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in the Los Angeles Times. In recent months, COVID-19 has devastated the black community as we die and lose jobs in disproportionate numbers. Systemic racism is killing us. Now we've watched a cop calmly crush the life out of yet another black man. I don't want to see buildings burn, but African Americans have been living in a burning building for many years, choking on the smoke as the flames burn closer and closer. Only an intellectual could justify these riots, said John Podhoretz in the New York Post. In many cities, rioters destroyed the stores and businesses of black and brown people and immigrants, as well as grabbing cakes from the Cheesecake Factory. But a phalanx of media and academic apologists not only excuse such behavior, they laud it as a courageous blow for social change. Trump's dreadful performance has again proved why he is exactly the wrong man to inhabit the White House through these times, said Quinn Hillier in WashingtonExaminer.com. Instead of expressing sympathy for the righteous frustration and anger of black Americans, Trump offered only bluster, force, and anger, and a cheap Bible-waving photo op. He's a disaster and a disgrace. America is at the breaking point, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. In this critical moment, our country is deeply ruptured along partisan and racial lines, with a political system so polarized it's dysfunctional. Amid a pandemic that's left more than 100,000 dead and an economy in freefall, we are tired, scared, angry, hurt, mistrustful, and divided. In desperate need of a healer, we're instead being led by a political arsonist, and the kindling is everywhere. What next? Could Trump follow through on his threat to send troops into U.S. cities, asked Noah Feldman in Bloomberg.com. With his history of announcing legally problematic measures and not implementing them, he may not even try, particularly after Secretary of Defense Mark Esper came out against it this week. But Trump has possible grounds to justify it. The Insurrection Act allows the president to deploy the military without congressional approval if violence obstructs the execution of the laws of the United States. Here, Trump might have a case. It's not totally absurd to say looting is obstructing execution of federal law if police can't stop it. Presidents Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson all invoked the act, said Ed Kilgore in NYMag.com. And George H.W. Bush sent troops to Los Angeles during the Rodney King riots. But to do it over the objection of local officials would be unprecedented. At this tenuous moment, it's hard to imagine anything more divisive. The controversy of the week. Policing the protests. Were cops too aggressive? The response of national law enforcement to the protests that roared the nation this week could be described as a police riot, said Charles Pierce in Esquire.com. In marked contrast to their kid glove handling of last month's lockdown protest by heavily armed white men, police dressed like quasi-military shock troops attacked protesters with tear gas, pepper spray, and rubber bullets. Smartphones captured searing images of cops in New York driving SUVs into a crowd of protesters, bludgeoning an old man with a cane to the ground in Salt Lake City, and tasering two unarmed college students in their car in Atlanta. In Minneapolis, two dozen officers in paramilitary riot gear marched down a quiet residential street, shouted, "Light 'em up," when they saw people sitting on their own front porch, and fired a fusillade of paint canisters at them. American cops are treating American citizens like they're under occupation, said Iraq veteran Rafael Noboa A. Rivera in the DailyBeast.com, but with all rules of engagement tossed out the window. In the savage killing of George Floyd and the brutalizing response to the protest and rioting that followed, we saw proof of the rot at the heart of policing in America. Sorry, but the only cure for a riot is overwhelming force, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Decades of civil disturbances have shown us that when cops take a restrained approach, as during the Los Angeles riots of 1992, it's like handing the mob a permission slip for more looting, arson, and violence. This week, when Minneapolis finally got more serious about policing itself, the result was an immediate and drastic diminishment of destruction. 33 cops were injured in New York City alone during the rioting, said Miranda Devine in NYPost.com, and four were almost burned alive when a rioter threw a Molotov cocktail into a police cruiser. When you consider the mortal danger police faced, the restraint showed by most officers was actually remarkable. Most African Americans don't agree, said Dan Frosch in the Wall Street Journal. The 2015 Ferguson riots highlighted the practice of police departments acquiring used military equipment and militaristic attitudes along with it. Aggressive warrior-style training has become the norm in many cities. Police unions also routinely defend brutal, racist cops. In Minneapolis, the cop who killed Floyd had 18 prior complaints, and the union chief is still defending him. The Obama administration tried to institute police reforms, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com, restricting the transfer of surplus military gear and working with departments to inculcate a guardian, not a warrior mindset. But then President Trump, who thinks it's funny to joke about police brutality, rescinded those modest reforms. Now we all must reap the whirlwind. The reality is that police killings of unarmed black men are extremely rare, said James Gagliano in WashingtonExaminer.com. Since 2015, demagogues have spread a false narrative about racist white cops hunting innocent black men for sport. But the statistics gathered by the Washington Post show that only 9 of the 235 African Americans killed by police in 2019 were unarmed. The videos we've all seen of cops beating, humiliating, and killing people of color don't lie, said former police chief Brandon Del Pozo in the New York Times. Until cops address these persistent patterns of mistreatment and bias, we will continue to be deeply resented in the communities we are supposed to protect. And our country will remain tragically divided. The Good Week, Bad Week segment starts with a good week for accessorizing after Ivanka Trump transported the Bible brandished by President Trump in his photo op at St. John's Episcopal Church in her white Max Mara purse, retail value $1,540. Asked by a reporter, "Is that your Bible?" Trump responded, "It's a Bible." It was a good week for fine distinctions. after Switzerland formally cleared sex workers to reopen their business while maintaining the official prohibition against close and constant physical contact. I am well aware of the bizarre aspect of the decision, said Health Minister Elaine Berset. It was a good week for going easy on the carbs and wine, with the release of new research showing that 49% of Americans worry that they will never get their pre-lockdown body back. The average American has gained 5 pounds during the pandemic. But it was a bad week for the end times after Tropical Storm Cristobal gathered strength in the Gulf of Mexico with the potential to turn into a destructive hurricane that could batter Americans already coping with pandemic and widespread social unrest. Forecasters warn that this will be a bad hurricane season. It's a bad week for Mississippi, named the least safe state in the country, based on analysis of crime, traffic fatalities, workplace safety, mass shootings, and other factors by the financial website WalletHub. Louisiana and Florida ranked 49 and 48 respectively, while Maine and Vermont were deemed the safest states. Finally, it was a bad week for bravado after President Trump told a Fox News host he went into the White House bunker during the protest for a tiny little short period of time, adding that it was more for an inspection. And a short news piece before we move on. Trump wants Russia in G7 meeting. President Trump announced last week that he wants to invite Russia to the Group of Seven economic summit, a move he had discussed with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The UK, Canada, and the European Union condemned the idea of including Russia, which was ousted from the group after Putin annexed Crimea in 2014. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said the UK would veto Russia's readmission. But as host of this year's summit, postponed from June to September, Trump can invite additional countries and said he also plans to include India, South Korea, and Australia. The G7 is a very outdated group of countries, Trump said, calling it common sense to include Russia because half of the meeting is devoted to Russia. Speaking of Russia, the briefing page article is titled Russia's 2020 Plan. The Kremlin has been emboldened by its successful attack on the 2016 election and is coming back for more. Will Russia interfere again? It never stopped. The Russian trolls and military hackers who undermined U.S. democracy in 2016 have continued their efforts to confuse and divide Americans. All U.S. intelligence agencies agree. As November approaches, the Kremlin is engaged in a multi-front cyber attack. Russia deployed social media bots to boost Senator Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, U.S. officials said. And last week, the National Security Agency announced that a hacking group called Sandworm, part of the Russian military unit that stole 50,000 Democratic National Committee emails in 2016, has launched a campaign to penetrate email servers in the U.S. Security experts were puzzled why Russia didn't wreak more havoc in 2016 after targeting election systems in all 50 states and penetrating Illinois registration databases. It was probably reconnaissance, Michael Daniel, a cybersecurity expert, told Congress, preparation for an even more ambitious future strike. What's their objective? To sow chaos, inflame existing political divisions, and destroy public faith in elections and democracy. Desinformacija, the tactic of pumping propaganda into rival nations, flourishes on social media, where Russians can easily pose as Americans. Russian deceit, however, is not limited to online activities. Russia infiltrated the National Rifle Association and evangelical groups in 2016 and organized at least 22 political rallies on U.S. soil. Russians tamper with election infrastructure and then exaggerate the success of their efforts, seeking to make Americans believe that election outcomes could be illegitimate. If Hillary Clinton won in 2016, Russia planned to spread the hashtag democracy RIP. What did Russia do in 2016? Four U.S. spy agencies, a GOP-controlled Senate committee, and special counsel Robert Mueller all concluded that Moscow ordered the attack in 2016 to spread disinformation and help elect Donald Trump. Russia's cyber operation, directly approved by Russian President Vladimir Putin, employed more than 800 people who created memes, fake accounts, and bogus news articles to stoke Republican fear and anger to convince Sanders supporters and African Americans that Clinton was corrupt and a racist. The DNC emails Russia stole and selectively published via WikiLeaks show that party officials wanted Clinton to win the primaries, angering Sanders supporters. In his 22-month investigation, Mueller did not find proof of an explicit criminal conspiracy between the Russians and the Trump campaign, but he did conclude that Russia had interfered in a sweeping and systematic fashion and that the Trump campaign had been receptive to Russia's help. Some 272 contacts between Trump's campaign and Russia-linked operatives were documented, with 38 in-person meetings. Trump aides overheard Roger Stone, later convicted of obstructing the Mueller probe, discussing coming WikiLeaks dumps with Trump. Trump's campaign manager, Paul Manafort, gave detailed state polling data to a Russian oligarch and later lied about it. Standing beside Putin at a summit meeting in Helsinki in 2018, Trump said, "I don't see any reason why Russia would have interfered." What's Russia's strategy this year? Disinformation campaigns will be more sophisticated. Russians often did a sloppy job imitating Americans in 2016, posting in broken English from accounts traceable to St. Petersburg. Now Russians are thought to be working from U.S. servers. An analysis of Russia-linked Facebook posts last fall found a focus on stirring up racial resentments, spreading fear of immigrants and Muslims, and inciting gun owners. The accounts targeted battleground states such as Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, Arizona, and Florida. Are election systems vulnerable? The nation's nearly 8,000 local voting jurisdictions use a complex patchwork of websites, databases, and hardware, giving hackers countless potential targets. In the 2018 midterm elections, an estimated one-third of jurisdictions used voting machines that were at least 10 years old. Russia is clearly keen to exploit American weaknesses, and in February, an aide to Director of National Intelligence, Joseph McGuire, told Congress that Moscow will try to ensure Trump's reelection. Trump berated McGuire for the briefing and fired him days later. The new DNI, former Representative John Ratcliffe, a Republican from Texas, is a fierce Trump defender who has questioned whether Russia really favored Trump in 2016. How is the U.S. fighting back? Last year, Congress allocated $425 million to beef up the security of state election systems. Many security experts say it's too late for states to implement major improvements by November. Still, intelligence services have toughened up U.S. defenses in some respects. On the day of the 2018 midterms, the U.S. military launched its first preemptive cyber attack against Russia, blocking internet access at the St. Petersburg troll farm. Nonetheless, 41% of Americans say the U.S. is not prepared to secure November's election. To succeed, Russia only needs Americans to doubt the results. You don't actually have to breach an election system in order to create the impression that you have, said Laura Rosenberger, director of the Alliance for Securing Democracy. Chaos is the point. Targeting vote totals. Election officials have insisted for years that voting systems are not connected to the internet and therefore can't be hacked. But it would take only a second of online activity for those machines to be compromised. And last August, a group of cybersecurity experts discovered dozens of back-end election systems in 10 states that had been connected to the internet, some for over a year. Moreover, many counties use wireless modems, some embedded directly in voting machines, to transmit results quickly to state officials. Russia is preparing to exploit this technology, allegedly sending GRU operatives to Rio de Janeiro and other cities to conduct operations through close access hacking, which allows break-in through Wi-Fi networks. Hackers could exploit components of the election hardware chain, including wireless-enabled printers, USB drives with registration rolls, or digital check-in tablets. Harri Hursti, a data security expert from Finland, believes tampering with vote counts is possible. Once you understand how everything works, Hursti says, you understand how fragile everything is. Moving into some of the best columns of the week, we'll start with one titled, Black Voters Won't Accept Klobuchar. The protest in Minneapolis should help Joe Biden cross one vice presidential contender off his short list, said Jonathan Capehart. Senator Amy Klobuchar, the Democrat from Minnesota, was reportedly a top contender to be Biden's running mate before George Floyd died under the knee of a white Minneapolis cop. That horrifying killing and the nationwide outrage it inspired over police racism and brutality highlighted why African Americans consider Klobuchar an unacceptable choice for vice president. Klobuchar was the top prosecutor in Hennepin County, which includes Minneapolis, from 1999 until she left for the Senate in 2007. Minneapolis police have a long history of racism allegations, and Klobuchar declined to prosecute police officers in 29 cases of civilian deaths, many of them involving black men. At the same time, Klobuchar promoted police crackdowns on small offenses like check forgery. Her statement after Floyd's death exemplifies the problem she has with African Americans. She called for a thorough investigation and blandly said everyone deserves to feel safe, without even mentioning the deaths of African Americans at the hands of police. If Biden tapped someone so woefully out of touch, it would fill black voters with rage. Will Trump find a way to win? Many Republicans think that President Trump will find a way out of his current troubles and win November's election, said Matthew Continetti. After shocking the pundits and pollsters in 2016 by defeating the heavily favored Hillary Clinton, Trump carries an aura of invincibility among the approximately 43% of Americans who've steadily supported him since he took office. But Trump's incredible run of good fortune has run out, and polls show him losing to Joe Biden by 5 to 10 points and trailing in swing states. The coronavirus has ruined Trump's signature issue, the economy. Not since 1940 has a president been reelected with a double-digit unemployment rate, and joblessness is now at 15% and heading into the 20s. Even in the best of times, Trump has never reached 50% approval, unlike every other president in 85 years of polling history. Could Trump pull a rabbit out of his hat and win the Electoral College despite losing the popular vote again. Perhaps something unexpected might happen, such as the coronavirus waning followed by a stunning economic rebound, or a series of badly damaging Biden gaffes. Right now, though, Republicans have every reason to be worried about November. This is an international How They See Us column. Racism, riots, and police brutality. Suffocated to death for the color of your skin, that is the terrifying reality of what it really means to be black in America right now, said Piers Morgan in the Daily Mail from UK. The entire world has seen the video of the arrest and killing of George Floyd. For nearly 9 excruciating minutes, white Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin crushed the life out of the handcuffed, defenseless Floyd. Even by the dreadful standards of police violence against black people in America, this heartless murder was a new low. Of course, American cities erupted in riots. How could they not? What might have quelled them was a president speaking with empathy and grace and pledging to end police brutality. Instead, as America burned, Donald Trump poured fuel onto the fire. He actually threatened war crimes against his own people, tweeting, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts." Now he is ordering the U.S. military into the streets. The hypocrisy is breathtaking, said the Global Times from China in an editorial. Hong Kong suffered months of violent unrest last year, during which rioters caused hundreds of millions of dollars in property damage and injured countless police officers. China never sent in the troops, yet Washington still arrogantly and unreasonably accused Beijing of human rights abuses. Meanwhile, the riots in the U.S. have lasted just a week, and efforts for reaching a peaceful solution have barely been made. But Trump is already deploying soldiers. The U.S. may have the world's strongest military, but its system of governments stands revealed as a failure. The COVID-19 epidemic there rages out of control, and now the social unrest exposes the deep-rooted problem of inequality and a lack of justice. Looted shops, burned out office buildings, smashed ATMs, and wrecked police cars litter America's streets, said Alexander Gasyuk in Rossiyskaya Gazeta from Russia. Protesters burned the U.S. flag right outside the White House. As Trump hid inside, tweeting threats that he would unleash vicious dogs on his oppressed citizens. The demonstrators want justice for Floyd, but the U.S. justice system nearly always lets police who killed unarmed black men go free. The Ferguson, Missouri officer who shot Michael Brown 6 times in 2012 was acquitted because he supposedly acted in self-defense. The same excuse got George Zimmerman, not even a cop but a neighborhood watch volunteer, off the hook for the murder of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. The U.S. has always reminded me of India, said Malachi O'Doherty in the Belfast Telegraph. Both are huge, rich countries with swaths of poverty and dereliction. And in both, it's perfectly acceptable to stride past homeless beggars. De facto segregation seems accepted as a normal, with black Americans relegated to an underclass. As in every caste system, state organs freely oppress those on the bottom. The entire world sees that clearly now. Until the U.S. lives up to its promise of equality for all, it can never be a model to the rest of us. The Last Word article is titled, How the Stock Market is Failing America. The market is doing a terrible job of allocating capital for economic growth, said Michael Steinberger in the New York Times Magazine, but a really good one of funneling wealth back to the richest investors. In early March, as it became clear that the coronavirus pandemic really wasn't a hoax, but was about to upend American life, I started texting my friend Paul, an investment advisor, about the stock market. I couldn't claim any particular financial expertise, but that didn't stop me from burdening Paul with my predictions. On Sunday, March 8th, I texted him that I thought the market was going to drop 25 to 30% over the next 3 to 4 months. When the S&P 500 plunged more than 7% the next morning, triggering an automatic halt to trading, I told Paul that I was revising my time frame to 3 to 4 hours, and added, good luck trying to catch this falling knife. The Dow Jones Industrial Average sank 2,000 points that Monday, the biggest one-day loss since October 2008. The following Monday, with the news growing more ominous, I sent Paul an updated prediction. The Dow was heading to 15,000. I was just spitballing, but given that the market fell almost 90% following the 1929 crash, a 50% decline now seemed plausible. Then the market began to rise. I was dismissive. How are you enjoying the suckers rally? I asked Paul. My skepticism only grew when I saw Jim Cramer, yeah, he's still around, on CNBC, saying that bears like me were betting against science and basically selling the country short. By then, however, stocks had climbed 3,000 points in about a week. The market now seemed impervious to bad news while surging on even the flimsiest pretext, and my mood had turned bitterly sarcastic. 5.5 million first-time jobless claims expected tomorrow. So limit up on the open, I texted Paul on April 8th. The next morning, the Labor Department announced that 6.6 million new claims had been filed. The Dow gained another 779 points. By that point, the market's rebound had become a source of morbid fascination for many. How could it be that stocks were heading higher in the face of a global pandemic and what's shaping up to be the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression? Wall Streeters were quick with answers. The Federal Reserve was pumping more than $1 trillion into the markets to stave off a financial meltdown. And besides, with bond yields at record lows, investors don't really have any palatable alternatives to stocks to place as places to put their money. Still, it was jarring, even macabre, to watch the market soar while tens of thousands of Americans were dying of COVID-19 and millions were losing their jobs as a consequence of the nation's economic shutdown. Even before the coronavirus struck, there were some trends that called into doubt how well the market was facilitating economic growth. Financial ledgermen played an outsized part in the vaunted bull market that took the Dow to almost 30,000 in February. The run-up in stock prices clearly didn't mirror the fortunes of most Americans, a fact laid bare by COVID-19. But it did greatly increase the fortunes of wealthy Americans who have by far the largest stake in the stock market. They also happen to be the people best positioned to ride out this crisis, which raises a question. Is the market detached from reality, or does it simply reflect the reality of those most heavily invested in it? Hoping to make sense of what's been going on with the stock market these past couple of months, I reached out to Bill Ackman, a billionaire investment manager who appears to have read the market perfectly. Ackman, 54, is one of Wall Street's more colorful figures, an activist investor renowned for both the returns he generates and the fights he has had with corporate executives as well as some financiers. Some people on Wall Street believe he is the inspiration for the Bobby Axelrod character on the cable series Billions. Back in March, Ackman gave an interview on CNBC in which he implored President Trump to shut down the country for 30 days to combat the coronavirus. Hell is coming, he warned, and unless Trump ordered the country to stay at home for a month, America will end as we know it. Despite the dire message, Ackman, who later revealed that by the time of the interview he had already made a $2.6 billion profit on credit insurance purchased to guard against a steep fall in the market, said he was buying stocks. When I spoke to Ackman in the middle of May, on a day the Dow gained another 912 points, he brought up that March 18th CNBC interview before I could even mention it. He reiterated that he was buying stocks at that point and had been since March 12th. Why, with the coronavirus bearing down on the country, had he turned so bullish that week? He told me he had become confident that the country would do what was needed to combat the pandemic. I said, "We're at the fork in the road. One leads to death and oblivion, and the other leads to long-term health and happiness. We're going to take the right path, and the way we get there is a little short-term pain, which is a shutdown of the country," is how he explained it. That was the bet I was making. But even with most of the country shut down, almost 100,000 Americans were now dead, and some 38 million were out of work. So why was the stock market going up? Ackman said that the market was heavily weighted to a small number of companies, Amazon, Apple, Google, Facebook, that were positioned to become even more dominant than they were before the crisis, and whose stock prices were rising in anticipation of that. Weak public companies were being culled. The virus killed older people, people with comorbidities, people with other health issues, and the same thing is true in business. The virus kills off companies that were structurally impaired already, while strong ones were poised not just to survive, but to prosper. Jeremy Siegel, who is 74 and teaches finance at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, is a prominent scholar of the markets, a fixture on CNBC who is often referred to as the Wizard of Wharton. He is famed for his bullishness. His 1994 book, Stocks for the Long Run, which argued that stocks were the best option for buy and hold investors, presaged, and some say helped spark, the 1995 to 2000 bull market. He and I spoke the morning after the Labor Department reported that the United States had lost 20.5 million jobs in April and that the jobless rate had spiked to 14.7%. The Dow, true to recent form, jumped 455 points that day. For Siegel, there was nothing strange about the markets rising despite the gruesome unemployment figures. Investors already knew they would be ugly. It's Principle 1 of Finance 101. Anything that is expected doesn't move the market, he told me. People who were dismayed by its upswing since mid-March didn't understand how the market works. Over 90% of the value of stocks is dependent on earnings more than a year in the future, he said. The market is very forward-looking. Investors weren't thinking 6 months ahead. They were thinking a year or two ahead, Siegel said, by which point the virus would probably have been brought under control. We'll have a U-shaped recovery, not a V, but the market is looking at the upper part of the U, Siegel said. He then pointed out that people confused by the market's recovery were overlooking something else. The sector of the economy being hit hardest by the crisis, the small business community, was not represented in major stock indexes like the Dow and the S&P 500. The market tracks the fortunes of big companies, not mom-and-pop shops. From a societal standpoint, Siegel said, the carnage on Main Street was terrible. He mentioned that he lived in Center City, Philadelphia. It's depressing to me. I walk by all the shuttered shops that made the neighborhood the neighborhood. I mean, there is something that is going to be lost. But the stock market is unmoved by sentimentality, and the closure of a corner coffee shop means one less competitor for Starbucks. The floor of the New York Stock Exchange is still considered a symbol of American capitalism, a shrine to its vitality and ingenuity. Its actual significance is greatly diminished these days, however, and not just because trading is now done electronically. A primary function of the stock market is supposed to be the allocation of capital to help companies grow. Yet fewer and fewer companies seem to want the market's help. In 1997, there were roughly 7,500 publicly traded companies in the United States. That number has since fallen by half to around 3,600. How is it that the stock market lost so many listed companies at a time when the economy was growing so much larger? And where have they all gone? Some are no longer in business, while more than a few have been swallowed up through mergers or acquisitions. Lately, though, the decline has been driven by the growing allure and financial muscle of private equity and venture capital. Private equity is now a $5 trillion market, having increased threefold over the past two decades, according to a Milken Institute study. And there are now nearly 8,000 private equity-owned companies in the United States. The appeal of private capital is obvious. Firms can obtain the funding they need without having to meet what they see as the onerous regulatory requirements of the public equity markets or having to answer to pesky Wall Street analysts. But if companies are increasingly meeting their financing needs elsewhere, it seems fair to ask what exactly the point of the stock market is these days. The growth of high-frequency trading, in which players dart in and out of the market seeking to profit from the tiniest price discrepancies, certainly lends credence to the idea that the market is now little more than a glorified casino. Some observers, though, contend that it actually serves a more nefarious purpose, that the market, instead of directing capital to its most productive uses, has essentially become a mechanism for draining capital out of the economy in order to funnel ever more of the nation's wealth upward. This is being done, goes the argument, primarily through stock buybacks. Companies repurchasing their own shares, reducing the number of available shares on the market in order to raise the price. This practice was effectively banned after the 1929 crash because regulators saw it as a form of stock manipulation. But that restriction was lifted in 1982 as part of the financial deregulation that started under the Reagan administration. During the 1980s and 90s, as shareholder value, the idea that a company's primary obligation is to generate returns for its owners, became a mantra of American business, and executive compensation was increasingly linked to a firm's stock price, buybacks surged. Yardeni Research reports that in 2019 alone, U.S. companies in the S&P 500 bought back $728.7 billion worth of their own stocks, which is equivalent to 3% of the country's GDP. Not only that, according to Goldman Sachs, buybacks constituted the single largest source of demand in the stock market, which was also the case in two of the previous 3 years. This was a period in which the stock market gained around 65%. To the extent that buybacks helped fuel the run-up, it suggests that the market was really just a hall of mirrors. It's possible that stocks will tumble again. Some of the biggest names on Wall Street, such as Stanley Druckenmiller and David Tepper, have suggested that the market is overvalued, and their skepticism might sober up other investors. Or it could be that the market is simply telling us something we intuitively know, that the strong will emerge from the current crisis even stronger, and the rich will grow even richer. Amazon's share price is up 45% since the market bottomed out on March 18th, and just reached an all-time high. Jeff Bezos has added another $34.6 billion to his net worth. Perhaps one lesson this crisis can reinforce is that we should stop thinking of the stock market as a barometer of national prosperity. Maybe it served that function in the past, but it doesn't now. Instead, the market has become an emblem and engine of American inequality. In that sense, its performance in recent months reflects our reality all too well. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times Magazine. We're on the Talking Points page. COVID-19, anti-vaxxers already mobilizing. A coronavirus vaccine may be a long way away, but there is already a threat on the horizon. Anti-vaxxers, said Adam Gabbat in The Guardian. No longer a fringe presence, anti-vaxxers boast growing numbers and expanded influence that could hold meaningful sway over Americans' willingness to take a COVID-19 vaccine and thwart efforts to build herd immunity. Recent polls point to trouble. A new Associated Press poll found that only 49% of Americans said they planned on getting a COVID-19 vaccination, with 20% certain they'd refuse it. In another poll, 4 in 10 Republicans said they were unlikely to get vaccinated. Led by a who's who of discredited scientists and conspiracy theorists, vaccine opponents have been highly visible at anti-lockdown protests. If they succeed in planting doubt in significant numbers of Americans, it could have dangerous consequences. For vaccine skeptics, COVID-19 offers a perfect storm, said Sarah Zhang in TheAtlantic.com. From botched initial testing to a flip-flop on face masks, the government's bungled pandemic response has squandered public trust. A vaccine would also enter a world where the pandemic itself has been deeply politicized, to the point where simply wearing a mask can be seen as a political act. Conspiracy theorists are flooding social media with crazy attacks on a vaccine that doesn't even exist yet, said Eric Zorn in the Chicago Tribune. A Yahoo News YouGov poll found last week that 44% of Republicans believe that Microsoft founder Bill Gates wants to use a mass vaccination campaign against COVID-19 to implant microchips that would be used to track people with a digital ID. Some lefty anti-vaxxers believe this too. Could the government mandate vaccination? Asked Matt Ford in NewRepublic.com. In a 1905 ruling on objections to a government-ordered smallpox vaccine, the Supreme Court found that the need to safeguard public health can outweigh matters of personal liberty. But religious freedom challenges to coronavirus vaccine might find a receptive audience on the Roberts Court. Public health officials must mobilize for a coming information war, said Kevin Roos in the New York Times. The country needs a pro-vaccine movement that can compete with a well-oiled anti-vaccine movement, skilled at fear-mongering, millions of lives, and trillions of dollars in economic activity may depend on it. Call transcripts. Do they redeem Flynn? Now we know why former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn repeatedly lied about phone calls with Russia's ambassador, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. FBI agents were eavesdropping on Ambassador Sergey Kislyak when he discussed U.S. sanctions with Flynn in late 2016. That wiretap exposed Flynn's false denials and led to his firing, indictment, and guilty plea. Republicans insist his lie was innocent and immaterial, and newly confirmed Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe released transcripts of the call last week to prove it. Well, the transcripts make Flynn look even less innocent. The Obama administration had just imposed sanctions to punish Russia for stealing and leaking Democratic emails and interfering in the 2016 election. In the call, Flynn urged Russia not to box us in by retaliating against the U.S. A delighted Kislyak agreed, telling Flynn the sanctions also punished the president-elect, that is, Trump. The two men discussed their secret common interest against the U.S. government. Sounds like collusion. The most chilling aspect of the transcript, said Jonathan Turley in TheHill.com, is the lack of anything chilling. Flynn never promised to revoke the sanctions. He said they'd be reviewed and urged Russia to resist a tit for tat. It was no crime for Flynn to seek a more frank, honest relationship with Russia, which Trump had promised in his campaign. Yet the FBI continued to pursue Flynn, eventually railroading him into a guilty plea that Attorney General William Barr now wants withdrawn, said Eli Lake in CommentaryMagazine.com. Flynn pleaded guilty because Mueller was squeezing him on an unrelated matter, his unreported lobbying work for the Turkish government in the U.S. That work showed horrendous judgment on Flynn's part, but he didn't deserve to be humiliated and ruined. Flynn betrayed the United States, said David Korn in MotherJones.com. A foreign power had mounted an unprecedented attack on our democratic system and flooded social media with disinformation. Yet the incoming National Security Advisor told Kislyak, in effect, we don't care about that. Republicans are desperately trying to turn Flynn into a victim. That's a diversion designed to obscure the fact that his cozy calls with Kislyak prove that there was something untoward and inappropriate in Trump World's engagement with the Russian Federation. And we'll finish with a quote from James Baldwin, who says simply, one discovers the light in darkness. That is what darkness is for. And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.